Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, October 15th, 2021. A British member of parliament is stabbed and killed while meeting with constituents. British police say the suspect has been arrested and there's no further danger to the public. Prime Minister Boris Johnson saying our hearts are full of sadness. Back in the U.S., an FDA advisory panel giving its approval of a booster shot for those who received the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. Biden administration plans to reinstate the Trump-era border policy that makes asylum seekers wait in Mexico for hearings in U.S. immigration courts to comply with a judge's order. And President Joe Biden in Connecticut promoting the affordable child care portion of his social spending proposal. Also there to see his old Senate colleague Chris Dodd and dedicate the Dodd Human Rights Center at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. This reporting from BBC News in Great Britain, Conservative Member of Parliament Sir David Amess has died after being stabbed at his constituency surgery, where voters can meet their MP and discuss concerns. Police said a 25-year-old man was arrested on suspicion of murder after the attack at a church in Lee-on-Sea. They said they recovered a knife and were not looking for anyone else in connection with the incident. Prime Minister Boris Johnson saying our hearts are full of shock and sadness at the loss of one of the kindest people in politics. Sir David, 69, had been an MP since 1983 and was married with five children. Reporting from BBC News, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, leader of the Conservative Party, speaking with reporters.
Well, I think all our hearts are full of shock and sadness today to the loss of Sir David Amess MP, who was killed in his constituency surgery in a church after almost 40 years of continuous service to the people of Essex and the whole of the United Kingdom. And the reason I think people are so shocked and saddened is, above all, he was one of the kindest, nicest, most gentle people in politics. And he also had an outstanding record of passing laws to help the most vulnerable, whether the people who are suffering from endometriosis, passing laws to end cruelty to animals, or doing a huge amount to reduce the fuel poverty suffered by people up and down the country. David was a man who believed passionately in this country and in its future. And we've lost today a fine public servant and a much loved friend and colleague. And our thoughts are very much today with his wife, his children, and his family.
And what was the sense of shock when you and your cabinet colleagues heard about this? This is not news, of course, that any of us would be expecting to hear on a Friday at a constituency surgery, and somebody who, of course, has been, as you say, a Conservative MP for a very long time, nearly 40 years. What was the reaction of you and your colleagues when that news filtered through?
I think everybody was deeply shocked and heart-stricken. And our thoughts, as I say, are very much with his family, with his wife, with his children. And for the rest, I mean, we must really leave the police to get on with their investigation. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Also, the Speaker of the House of Commons has said today, of course, he's shocked, saddened, and distressed too, but he says this also raises the issue of MPs' safety. Now, we've had two MPs from the two main parties at Westminster killed in the space of 5 years. This is a problem, isn't it? An urgent problem that needs to be debated to protect our democracy.
I think what we need to do now is let the police get on with their investigation, and I'm sure that all those issues will be considered in the proper time. But this is I think this is a moment for us to think of Sir David, his wife, his family, and our thoughts are very much with them. Thank you very much. Thank you.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson with reporters. The British Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer, main opposition, saying it's a dark and shocking day and saying we have heartbreakingly been here before, referring to the death of another member of parliament 5 years ago, Jo Cox, who was murdered in her constituency. Keir Starmer going on, we will show once more that violence, intimidation, and threats to our democracy will never prevail over the tireless commitment of public servants simply doing their jobs. Another tribute to the member of Congress who was killed today from longtime friend and fellow Conservative member David Davis.
the thing you can say about David is he was an absolutely decent man. The reason Shiloh said, you know, everybody loved him in the house was he was the sort of person who had no side to him. He was completely decent, completely straightforward, very outspoken sometimes. You know, he was a big supporter of Mrs. Thatcher in her day. And I've known him for over 30 years. And he was the sort of person that actually made Parliament work. You know, you hear about, you know, the big names, the Borises and the Rishis and so on. But actually, Parliament depends on people like David who serve on the committees, as you said, take part in campaigns. If I was running a campaign, it's pretty much the first telephone call would be to David. But the sort of person that actually makes our Parliament and our democracy work, and which is why it's such a terrible, tragic paradox, really, because he killed doing in some ways the most important thing for a member of parliament, and that is contact with their own constituents, helping them, talking them through problems, putting things right for them, representing them. And of course he was brilliantly good at that. I mean, when David had a prime minister's question, it wouldn't be about this, unlikely to be anyway, about the situation in Syria, be about the situation in his constituency and a particular problem that had come up or a particular issue that needed to be dealt with. You know, and this was true day in, day out. He was always there, always doing his work, and I say over decades.
David Davis is a member of Parliament interviewed on GB News on the stabbing death today of another member of Parliament, David Arness. Essex police putting out a statement after the arrest of one suspect. We are not looking for anyone else in connection with the incident, and we do not believe there is an ongoing threat to the wider public. And this from BBC News. A government source told the BBC the man arrested is a British national who, according to initial inquiries, is of Somali heritage. This is Washington Today. President Joe Biden visiting a child development center in Hartford, Connecticut today to discuss his plan to lower the cost of child care. He wants to make child care free for lower income families and ensure families making up to 150% of their state's median income pay less than 7% of their salaries on child care. Biden administration says the average annual cost of child care in Connecticut, for instance, is $16,000, and a typical four-person household in the state would need to spend more than 26% of their income for two young children each year. Here's part of the president's remarks at that center in Connecticut.
I wanted to come here today because too many folks in Washington still don't realize it isn't enough just to invest in our physical infrastructure. We also have to invest in our people, and that's what the second bill does, the Build Back Better initiative. Seeing children and educators here at this center is a perfect reminder of what our families need for and our economy needs so badly to be able to thrive. You know, you all know the statistics, particularly the teachers here. A child coming out of a single-parent house where there's real difficulty will hear literally a million fewer words spoken, not different words, spoken, than the child coming out of a middle-class household. And so no matter what you say, you start them at the same age, at age six or seven, five or six in school, they're already behind the curve. How can we compete in a world of millions of Americans' parents, especially moms, can't be part of the workforce because they can't afford the cost of childcare or elder care, I might add. Elder care. They're the sandwich generation getting crushed. Here in Connecticut, the average annual cost to bring your toddler to a quality child care center is about $16,000 a year. That's what it is around the country. Some places more, some places a little less. A lot of money. It's $16,000 after taxes, after you pay your taxes. So the average two-parent family with two young kids spends 26% of their income on child care every year. My Build Back Better plan is going to change that. It's going to cut the cost of child care for most Connecticut families literally in half. No middle-class family will pay more than 7% of their income on child care. None, period. And that's going to help parents get back into the workforce and make ends meet.
President Joe Biden in Hartford, Connecticut. Child care programs, just one part of a multi-trillion dollar large social safety net expansion bill still under negotiation among Democratic lawmakers and the factions among them. Since it's only going to be Democratic votes needed to pass the final version, which under the budget reconciliation process cannot be filibustered by the Republican minority in the Senate. President Biden spoke about the state of those talks. He also mentions former President Bill Clinton, who was in the hospital.
There's not a single solitary thing that we can't achieve if we do it together. So I'm hopeful. There's a lot of questions the press is going to want to ask me, I know, about how are the negotiations going and how we're going to get this done and so on. Well, I told you before what my neurosurgeon years ago said when I had that aneurysm. He said, your problem, and that was then a center, your problem, Senator, is you're a congenital optimist. But I'm convinced we're going to get this done. I'm convinced we're going to get it done. We're not going to get $3.5 trillion. We'll get less than that, but we're going to get it. And we're going to come back and get the rest. So I want to thank you all, and God bless you. And I know you're asking about President Clinton. I've been exchanging calls. He seems to be, God willing, doing well. And when I talk to him, I'll let you all know. But in the meantime, thank you for taking the time to be here. And I've say this again, the press heard me say it. For all you elected officials, it's like a busman's holiday for you. Come to have to listen to another politician speak. But I am really, and I mean this without exception, I'm so proud to be associated with each one of you. You're honorable, decent, smart women and men, and there's a lot we can get done. So thank you very much.
President Joe Biden in Connecticut. On former President Clinton, 75 years old, hospitalized this week for what is said to be a urological infection that developed into a blood infection known as sepsis, according to his aides. Also on the negotiations on the budget reconciliation bill, President Biden also saying today that free community college, something he's proposed, may be one thing that gets cut. He said, I don't know that I can get it done, but I've also proposed free community college like you've done here in the state of Connecticut. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh also speaking today about the budget bill negotiations. He was interviewed by Washington Post opinion writer Jonathan Capehart.
Secretary Walsh, I want to pick up on something, a phrase that you used, a sense of urgency in terms of getting things done to move the country ahead. And it, to my mind, it was an echo of something that White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said in an interview, I believe it was with the Pod Save America guys, where in terms of talking about the reconciliation bill, about how there's this sense of urgency that they can't keep negotiating Democrats, negotiating with each other over what's in the reconciliation bill. From where you sit, does that sense of urgency that you're talking about also apply to what Jen Psaki is talking about in terms of the sense of urgency to get the reconciliation bill done so that those things you were talking about earlier, housing and child care and things that are in the reconciliation bill, get passed on the president's desk for signature and then out to the American people?
I agree with that 100%. I mean, there's no question about it. We're talking about infrastructure. And when I say infrastructure, we're talking about the whole two packages that we're talking about, both the physical infrastructure, the construction that people can see, and the infrastructure of laying down infrastructure for people's future livelihoods. And there is a sense of urgency because once those bills get passed, we need to get those investments out the door. We need to get those investments into states, into cities and towns, into workforce development. We need to get those investments to the American people as soon as possible because we can't lose any more time. We need to continue to move forward. You know, the first Friday every month, we're going to have a jobs day. And, you know, in the month of July, I was really happy. In the month of August, we had almost a million jobs. They ended up over being a million jobs. That was great. But that doesn't mean you can sit back and rest on your laurels. You have to continue to move forward. The next 2 months, I think, was 243,000 jobs. And then last month was about 200. I don't have the exact number in my head right now. But we clearly have work to do. And it's not just the federal government work. It's all of us working collectively together. That means industry, business, government. We need to continue to work together.
So if I heard you correctly, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounded to me like your message to Congress and to congressional Democrats negotiating over the reconciliation bill, get it done sooner rather than later. The sense of urgency is now.
You're going to get me in trouble, but that is what we need in America right now. Those bills, we will have never, whatever the number is in the reconciliation package, whatever that number is, I don't remember any other time in the history of our country, well, maybe since Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that we have made an investment in the CARES economy in our country, in child care, adult care, job training, as if that's going to come out of that bill.
Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, a discussion hosted by The Washington Post today. The budget reconciliation bill will also have tax proposals, tax increases, to pay for most of the spending. This article at Fox Business, House Republicans plan to unveil a bill on Friday to block the Biden administration's deeply controversial proposal to give the Internal Revenue Service additional scrutiny over most Americans' bank accounts in order to crack down on wealthy tax cheats. The GOP lawmakers' legislation, known as the Prohibiting IRS Financial Surveillance Act, would prevent the IRS from adopting any form of Biden's proposal by barring new reporting requirements for banks and would require them to disclose information on individuals' private accounts. The bill sponsor is Congressman Drew Ferguson of Georgia. He was interviewed on Fox Business on Thursday ahead of the bill's introduction today.
I, like every American, am furious at this proposal. We don't know where it came from, but I have a feeling it came from Nancy Pelosi. And this is something that every American is going to be outraged by, and they should fear it. Having the IRS look into your bank accounts without probable cause is unacceptable, and it's time for Congress to stand up and say no to this.
So what can we do to stop it, Congressman?
Well, David, I'm introducing a bill tomorrow to stop the IRS surveillance, illegal surveillance of America's bank accounts. It's a bill. It's a very simple bill. It just prohibits the IRS from doing this. And look, here's one of the real challenges with this bill right now is that it is going to be used as a pay for in their reckless scheme, their reconciliation scheme, to give a tax break to millionaires and billionaires in blue states. This is wrong. And look, David, it doesn't matter if the number is $1, $600, or $10,000. You cannot allow the government to look at your private property. These bank accounts are the property of the American citizen, and the IRS has no business snooping in there.
Are there any Democrats opposed to it that you know of?
I can't imagine that reasonable people on either side of the aisle would think that this is a good idea. And I think every single American, whether they're Republican, Democrat, whether they're moderates and independents, it does not matter. They do not trust the IRS to look at their bank accounts. Why would you need to do that? Are you saying that every single American is a tax cheat? The whole notion of closing the tax gap with this is ludicrous.
Congressman Drew Ferguson, Republican of Georgia, on Fox Business Channel on Thursday, talking about the bill that he introduced today in the House. More than 10,000 union workers at the machinery company Deere still on strike. They walked out about midweek after rejecting offers of 5% raises for some workers, 6% raises for others. Deere is based in Illinois, but has 6,000 of its employees in Iowa. And that state's governor, Kim Reynolds, asked about the strike by a reporter from the Quad City Times.
What's kind of your statement on the John Deere situation?
Yeah, well, hopefully, you know, they'll work through the process and they'll get the employees back to work sooner rather than later. I think it's a great company that supports and appreciates its employees. And this is a process that they go through. So, you know, especially with what we're dealing with workforce today, I'm sure that they understand that. And I have confidence that they'll come to some resolution.
What, if any, conversations, I guess, have you or your staff had with either John Deere or the union?
No, I haven't. This is a process that they go through. It's mm-hmm. in place to handle these very issues. And so this is a good company. We have great workers. You know, they've been invested in Iowa for a long time. And so I'm confident that they'll be able to find resolution. And hopefully they'll be able to do that sooner rather than later.
Okay. Can you talk about what potential impact this could have on the state if, you know, things drag out for too long? We've been told that November is kind of, you know, when they were supposed to start production on, you know, new combines and harvesters.
Yeah. Well, so I think that both parties have an interest in getting this settled sooner rather than later. And so hopefully they'll continue to come to the table. They'll negotiate what those terms look like and we'll get them up and going. But again, you know, they've got orders. It's they'll work through it. And I'm not going to project. My hope is, and I'm confident that they'll get that worked out. I haven't had a chance to talk to them, but I know that both parties are interested in finding resolution. And so I'm sure they'll get it.
That's Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on Thursday with a reporter. U.S. Senator from Iowa Chuck Grassley, Republican, like Kim Reynolds, also speaking Thursday with the Des Moines Register about this strike from the workers from Deere.
At midnight, thousands of John Deere workers went on strike across the state. What kind of message do you have for the workers?
Well, obviously, they're exercising their right to do that, of collective bargaining, and that's a decision those workers made. And under the laws, we have to respect it. I don't have anything to say about it because I don't know the issues that are at stake. And I didn't even know they were on strike except you told me. But John Deere's workers don't go on strike very often, so there must be a great deal of satisfaction between management and the unions there and the workers there.
That's Senator Chuck Grassley on Thursday. He tweeted today, "For many years, I was a factory worker and union member and did go on strike as part of that experience. The Deere workers and their families now face a stressful situation, and I hope good faith bargaining can bring the dispute to swift conclusion for the good of all parties and our Iowa economy." There's this tweet from Iowa Congresswoman Cindy Axne, a Democrat. "Our workers are the backbone of our economy, and they deserve the pay and benefits that provide them a middle-class life in retirement. That's why I stand in solidarity with the hardworking members of the UAW as they begin their strike for a fair contract." On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 382, NASDAQ up 73, S&P up 33. From CNN, vaccine advisors for the U.S. Food and Drug Administration voted unanimously Friday to recommend a booster dose of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine at least 2 months after people get the first dose. The FDA's Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee voted 19-0 to recommend the extra dose for all recipients of the J&J Janssen vaccine 18 and older. They asked to simplify the original question being posed by the FDA, which had asked the committee to say whether the data showed that waiting 6 months or longer after getting the first shot would provide an even stronger immune response. Reporting from CNN. During the deliberations, which were live streamed, Dr. Peter Marks, director of the FDA's Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, spoke to committee members about why there were different booster proposals for the one-dose J&J vaccine versus the two-dose Moderna and Pfizer vaccines.
One of the things that may be helpful, perhaps, is trying to put in perspective exactly why there is enough concern with this vaccine that one might need a booster, given that there does seem to have been some conflicting push-pull shown. I provided Kathleen with a slide. I'd like to try to bring that up right now. And I'm going to ask, I'm going to beg indulgence from Dr. Rubin, because this does come from the New England Journal from the past week or so. But just to give people an idea, in the real world, there is a difference in effectiveness of the one-dose regimen versus the two-dose regimens of the mRNA vaccines that appears present. Now, this is a study in adults greater than 50 years of age, or at least 50 years of age, and it's only one of a number of representative studies that does seem to show that there is a difference in effectiveness, including against hospitalization. So let's just leave aside the moderate COVID-19, where we can have a discussion about whether it's important to prevent that some other time later on. Right now, in terms of hospitalization, you can see at least here that there is about a, you know, it's roughly 20-25% difference there in rates of hospitalization. And so that, I think, is one of the things, and that change over time, that is leading this question. And I agree with Dr. Rubin that it is perfectly reasonable for the committee to discuss whether a second dose after 2 months for those who haven't received the vaccine previously, or a second dose whenever possible for those who have received the vaccine more than 2 to 3 months ago is appropriate. So I hope that provides some clarification of this. In retrospect, probably we should have presented a broader review of the real-world evidence, but I hope that this at least provides a kind of a start of where the of where the FDA's thoughts are coming from.
Peter Marks is with the FDA at today's FDA Advisory Committee meeting. The FDA and after that, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will now be considering the committee's advice to allow the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine booster. Also pending from previous approvals, Moderna's COVID-19 booster and Pfizer's booster already fully approved. Today's advisory committee hearing also discussing preliminary data from a government mix-and-match study suggesting J&J recipients may have a stronger immune response if they get either a Moderna or Pfizer booster rather than a second J&J dose. Also, related to COVID, we found out today exactly when the U.S. will lift border restrictions for fully vaccinated international travelers, both by air and land. White House Assistant Press Secretary Kevin Munoz tweeting that it will be on November 8th. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now app or wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. Justice Department says it plans to ask the Supreme Court to block Texas's new abortion law after a federal appeals court ruled that the statute can remain in effect while it hears the Biden administration's legal challenges, that law banning abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. And a U.S. Capitol Police officer has been arrested on charges of obstruction of justice after allegedly telling a person who was later criminally charged for taking part in the January 6th attack on the Capitol to delete Facebook posts and then also deleting his own Facebook messages to and from that person. From the Washington Post, the Biden administration is preparing to re-implement the Trump-era border policy known as the Migrant Protection Protocols in mid-November if the Mexican government agrees to accept the return of asylum seekers to its territory. In August, a U.S. District Court in Texas ordered the Biden administration to restart MPP, also known as Remain in Mexico, faulting the White House for ending the program improperly. The Supreme Court upheld the decision, forcing Biden officials to restore a policy the president has deplored as inhumane. That was from the Washington Post. The Deputy White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, asked about this by reporters on Air Force One.
If Mexico doesn't agree to the terms of the Remain in Mexico policy, what do you all do from there?
So let me just step back so that folks, you're talking about the Remain in Mexico. Okay, so it's hard to hear you from back there.
Is it possible for you to come up a little? I feel like we're...
I'm trying to hold on so I don't fall. So late yesterday, DHS filed a court-ordered report outlining steps that it has taken pursuant to the court order to reinstate MPP. They and DOJ can speak more to that process more specifically. But as we've previously said, as a result of the injunction, we have to comply in good faith and take steps to reinstate this court-ordered MPP, and we will be doing just that. DHS has appealed that injunction and announced that it intends to issue a second memorandum terminating MPP that intends to address the concerns raised by the courts. The Biden administration will follow the law and abide by the court's order to restart the court-ordered MPP, and the DHS and DOJ can speak again more specifics on this process, but that's where we are currently with that.
Deputy White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with the president and reporters flying on Air Force One. The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, tweeting, Republicans have been calling for President Biden to reinstate the Trump-era Remain in Mexico policy for 9 months. What took him so long? Will he now forcefully implement this effective border security tool, or will the Biden version of Remain in Mexico just be window dressing? And more from the Washington Post article on this. They write the Trump administration used MPP to return more than 60,000 asylum seekers across the border to Mexico, requiring them to wait outside U.S. territory as their claims were processed in U.S. courts. President Biden today joining his former Senate Democratic colleague Chris Dodd for a dedication of the Dodd Center for Human Rights at the University of Connecticut. It's named for former Senator Dodd, and also his father, former U.S. Senator Thomas Dodd, who was also a prosecutor during the Nuremberg trials and helped convict the former Nazi leaders. Chris Dodd served in the U.S. Senate from 1981 to 2011, overlapping a couple of decades with Joe Biden's service 1973 to 2009. Chris Dodd spoke about their long friendship.
My friendship with Joe Biden goes back years as Senate colleagues, and it strongly continues to this day. A friendship that is both personally and substantively a grounding. When my sister passed away some years ago in Rhode Island, who came to Rhode Island and walked unannounced into that funeral home? It was then the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden. When my older brother was diagnosed with cancer, who did I call first for advice and counsel on what to do? My friend, Joe Biden. And we were both campaigning for the presidential nomination, which you've all certainly forgotten, in 2007. Participating in those endless debates, which candidate flew to and from the debate with me? My friend Joe Biden. Now allow me to quickly add, we did so because of our deep friendship for each other, but we are also both broke, I might add as well. In today's highly polarized political world, such joint ventures, regrettably, would be unlikely. So I'm grateful to my friend for being with us today. But there are strong substantive reasons as well for our friendship. In all our years together, I know of no other Senate colleague with whom I served who cared more or fought harder for the fundamental human rights of people at home and around the globe.
Former Senator Chris Dodd at the Dodd Human Rights Center at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. He was followed by President Joe Biden, who also opened his remarks by remembering his friendship with the former senator.
Chris and I have known each other for a long time. But if you'll excuse the point of personal privilege, as we used to say in the Senate, I saw up close how he fought for human rights and human dignity in the Senate. Do you know my measure, Madam Ambassador, Ambassador Kennedy? You know what my measure is? People who tell me they care about people and then disrespect a waitress or a waiter. People who tell me they care about how, in fact, people are entitled to be treated with dignity and walk by someone at a shoe side stand and suddenly say hello. People who do not do the just simply decent things for ordinary people. That's the real measure. I've never seen Chris, figuratively or speaking, walk by anybody. I've never seen him, nor his wife, nor his two brilliant, beautiful daughters. I remember the passion and eloquence that you brought to the floor, Chris, whether you were fighting for American families or serving as the Senate leader, leading voice on engagement with Latin America and the Caribbean. And your brother, the ambassador, did a pretty damn good job as well. I think that the work this center is doing to bring human rights to the forefront of public understanding is making a real and immediate impact for all young people today. I think it's going to rate high among your family's many great and lasting contributions to the country. And I know this is truly a family commitment for the Dodds. So thank you for inviting me to be part of this. I really mean it. It's an honor to be able to be here. Of course, I owe Chris. I remember, as he pointed out, when we were both running for president back in 2007, with almost no cash in either of our campaigns. You let me hop a ride with you in a twin-engine prop plane, true story, from our Senate vote in D.C. to a Democratic debate in New Hampshire. We were on our way to the debate one other time, but the whole way up, we just laughed and told stories before we were debating one another. Then the next day, to get back to the Senate to vote, we had to flag down a young, remember this? Flag down a young senator named Barack Obama to get to even open the airport. God's truth, remember that, Chris? Here, he'd just been there 2 years. He was on my foreign relations committee. I was chairman. I said, can you get the airport open for us? I used to kid Barack. I couldn't understand why he so soundly defeated me in that primary. And then I realized when he'd be introduced by the voice of God. I get introduced by Johnny Scannafani. So it took a while for me to figure all this out. Luckily, Chris, I got to travel in a much nicer plane these days. travel in anytime you would like.
President Joe Biden in Connecticut, the University of Connecticut. The new Dodd Center for Human Rights was known as the Thomas J. Dodd Research Center since its opening in 1995, named for Chris Dodd's father. But the University of Connecticut Board of Trustees voted unanimously in August to rename it. So now it's named for both of them, Thomas Dodd and Chris Dodd, both former senators. And as mentioned, Thomas Dodd was a prosecutor during the Nuremberg trials after World War II. The acting chair of the Federal Communications Commission, Nathan Symington, was a speaker at today's 15th anniversary gala lunch of the Free State Foundation. One of his signature issues is whether the FCC should set standards not only for the transmission of wireless spectrum, but also for the devices that receive the signals. He says this is going to be a major issue, especially with widespread coming of 5G networks, because there are so many more signals being used by so many people for so many purposes, and they already have seen cases of disruption from interference. Here's part of his remarks.
Operating our wireless future on the backs of cheap edge devices that are sensitive to interference in an increasingly spectrally dense mid-band environment will potentially be a very large expense when these devices fail or run into the problems. I don't know how big, but I'm willing to bet that it's smaller than the expense of the implementation of receiver standards. So I hear from some other corners that requiring better receivers stifles innovation. Many of those same players serve incumbents in the federal bands, and I'm not sure that they've made the same case to the NTIA regarding federal receiver standards, although it's always been available for them to make. Naturally, I'm skeptical that the bare existence of standards for minimum performance are likely to stifle innovation. But here's one thing about which I'm not skeptical. It's at present easier to build a cheap wireless device with poor receiver performance in China than it is here. What happens when the industry implements better receiver standards? Do consumers pay a bit more? Possibly. But do we also define what constitutes the minimum viable product in a way that supports higher quality of service and may exclude low-quality players that are in, coming from foreign manufacturers, potentially making it feasible for domestic manufacturers to compete to make higher quality devices with better components? Some of these will even be made domestically. That sounds to me like it would have a protective effect on innovation, actually, and at a minimum, it would mitigate some of the dominance of foreign manufacturers in the domestic market.
FCC Acting Chair Nate Symington, he concluded his speech today by saying that in the end, it's probably better for the government not to do this.
We are at the Free State Foundation, and I did not come here to argue for an overbearing, arbitrary commission U case on this subject. I hope the commission doesn't ultimately regulate receivers, after I just gave you all the reasons it should. I suspect that the standards bodies and trade associations are in better positions than the Commission to project likely problems and anticipate them without fear of drawing a heckler's veto from their most marginal actors as they lay out the benefits and the harms. I'm sure Commission staff also would not thank the 8th floor for handing them the massive headache of writing regulations covering innumerable, highly disparate services, devices, models, and use cases. Our best bet, instead, is to serve as a clearinghouse to encourage industry coordination and auto-regulation. But perhaps it's not a bad thing if the specter of regulation from time to time looms up in order to help industry act. Eventually, either this issue will be resolved, and I'm sure that industry will do that, or, you know, the downside is perhaps one day the Commission will find its hands tied by public opinion and will be forced to do something. And the best thing to do would just be to avoid the necessity and to move forward as the industry, speaking with one voice to address the problem before it manifests. I think that's the way to avoid strict controls that are unlikely to suit everyone properly, and instead to get to nuanced, thoughtful, capacious treatment of the issue.
Nate Symington is the acting chair of the Federal Communications Commission, nominated by President Trump, assuming office in December of 2020, speaking today at a lunch hosted by the Free State Foundation, which describes itself as a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank whose purpose is to promote, through research and educational activities, understanding of free market, free speech, limited government, and rule of law principles at the federal level and in Maryland, and to advocate laws and policies true to these principles. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. For more Washington, D.C. top stories, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, at cspan.org/connect. I hope you have a good night and good weekend.